Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Today on the 10 Adventures podcast, we're talking with my co-host, Karen, who's currently in Europe on a grand cycle tour. And I'm excited to talk to her because I've been following along on her Instagram. And I know we get lots of questions about what it's like traveling in Europe this time of year and at this stage of the pandemic. And so we get to hear firsthand from Karen, who's there with her husband and has been there for about 2 weeks. Hi, Karen. How's it going?
Oh, pretty good on a rainy day in northern Spain.
First off, I know a question we get a lot at 10 Adventures is, what's it like to travel overseas, to travel in Europe right now? I was wondering if you could maybe just share, you know, big picture, what have your experiences been so far into your trip?
Well, I mean, so far we've had a really fantastic time. We flew from Western Canada into Paris. We were doing a bike trip, so we flew with our bikes on Air Canada. And then once we got to Paris, we rented a car and drove our bikes while they were still in boxes to Nantes, which is along the Loire, where we were going to start our bike trip. That whole process went quite smoothly.
One question people always ask is, you know, what kind of paperwork do I need to get into Europe? Do people have to be double vaxxed? Do they have to have a PCR or an antigen test before, you know, before they leave? What were your experiences like?
Well, my understanding, because I was following the situation pretty closely before we left, and my understanding is that it's really country specific as to what's required. For France, where we were flying into, we did not need to have any kind of COVID testing done because we're both doubly vaccinated, and the vaccine had to be within a certain amount of time, meaning you couldn't just have had your vaccine and then entered without a COVID test. There has to have been, I think it was 14 days that had lapsed since your second vaccine. So we did need proof of vaccination when we flew in. If we weren't vaccinated, we could still have come, but we would need a PCR test. And then there was a form that we got from the Air Canada website that you filled out, which was more or less just certifying that you didn't have any symptoms of COVID while you were flying. And that was about it. And actually, I was really surprised at how smoothly it all went. You know, I always found that arriving in Europe was pretty easy as a Canadian. And this just didn't feel that much more difficult. We landed in, we went to immigration, we showed our passports, we gave them our vaccine information, they stamped our passports, and that was it.
It sounds really easy. I still haven't taken a flight since the pandemic, so I feel like I'd be stressed just going on the flight. But you had a couple connections to get all the way to Paris. What was it like being on the flight? Were you stressed out at all, or, you know, being in the different airports, or did it feel really normal to you?
Well, the airports weren't as busy, although they were busier than I was expecting. I think I was expecting them to be really quite dead, and they were busier. But my impression was that they're pretty strict about masking, and we were lucky because we were flying on points that we'd been saving up for a few years, so we got to fly business. So that meant we actually had more space on the plane around us, so we were de facto distanced from other people. But, I mean, people were really good about masking around us when they were up and wandering. And on the flight, they said that you could, you know, you were only to take your mask off when you were eating or drinking. And it looked like everyone was complying with that. So, maybe a little bit more stressful, but not terribly.
You spent some time cycling in France, and they have an electronic kind of vaccine passport system. Can you maybe describe how you got your vaccine passport and, you know, what the system is and what does it mean for people who are traveling?
Well, France has an immunization record that you have to show to go into any restaurant, bar, and I think any kind of group setting, like if you were going to cinema or sports things. And we were, you know, impressed that really they were asking to see them when we would go into a restaurant. So it was a QR code that, you know, your server would just check with their phone. And I think it's probably similar to what British Columbia is doing right now in Canada, although I left before that started, so I'm not quite sure. As far as applying for it, the French system, when I applied, you just sent an email in with the paperwork that they needed. The funny thing is that before we got our QR codes, they sent us an email back saying that, oh, they changed the system and now you had to apply online. So right now it's an online application through the French government, and they ask for a copy of your passport. They ask for your official vaccine record. And then they also ask for a copy of your travel details. So I think that's to ensure that you are in fact traveling to France. And so you upload those to the website with, you know, your personal demographics, and then they send you a message when your QR code is ready to download. And then in France, they have their own app, which is, I think it's Tous Anti-COVID, so All Against COVID, that you download your QR code to, that you show at every restaurant that you go into. So it's pretty slick, actually, the whole process. The only thing, and I've been reading it in some online forums, is it's quite variable, the delay. So if you were traveling to France, you'd probably want to send your application in several weeks before you go. I think I got my QR code within about a week, but my husband's took more like 25 days for him to get his, which is longer than usual. Now, the good thing about having a French QR code is that a QR code for one European country is good for the rest of the EU countries. So if I end up needing a QR code to travel elsewhere in the EU, then I can use this one I have from France. I've just biked into Spain now, and my understanding is they're not using a QR code in Spain, and they don't ask for proof of vaccine in Spain to go into a restaurant.
That was actually one of my questions. I know there's lots of people who are asked questions, you know, I want to go visit several European countries. What's it like to transit, you know, between one country and the next? So you just went from France to Spain. Is it just like it's always been that, you know, you just kind of are all of a sudden in a different country and, you know, there's no one checking vaccination status at the border, or, you know, are hotels checking anything? Or is it just, you know, you're in the EU and, you know, once you're in, things are pretty normal?
I can't say for sure because I think it depends how you transit between countries. So, for example, I was reading online about entering Spain, and if you're entering by water or air, they still have requirements that you need regardless of where you're coming from. But we were riding across a bridge and there was nothing. And I'm not sure about trains. Like, I'm not sure if, but I get the impression that there wouldn't be an issue if you're going through a land border.
Now, as we've gone through all of the details and the questions people are asking, let's hear a little bit about your trip. And so you land in Paris, you get your bike, or you rent a car. What happened next?
We had gone on this trip with plans to do the Eurovelo 1. So the Eurovelos are a group of paths that cross countries throughout the EU. There's a lot of them. I don't know exactly how many, but there's a lot. Several years ago, we cycled part of the Eurovelo 8, which goes along the Mediterranean. And we started in Barcelona and cycled to Nice. And then later in that trip, we came back to Paris along the Eurovelo 6, which includes the Loire cycling path. The Eurovelo 1 starts way in the north of Europe and travels down to Portugal. So it's a really long cycling path, but we decided we would pick it up in France. So we decided to start in Nantes. The thing about the French part of this route is that the French have really developed this cycling route well. What I heard was that the Eurovelo 1 and the Eurovelo 6, which is the Loire cycle route in France, they are the two, you know, best developed cycling routes. And also I think some of the Eurovelos that go through Germany and Austria are similarly very well developed. In France, the Eurovelo 1, that part is called La Vélo Odyssée, so the bike odyssey, I'm assuming. And it was very, very impressive. I mean, it's for the most part, like for the majority, a separate biking lane. You know, occasionally you have to go a short distance on a road or something. A lot of it is paved and very, very well signposted. I mean, it's really amazing that a country can create this gorgeous cycle path along such incredible scenery and just mark it so well for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers. At this point, we've cycled, I think, 950 kilometers on that cycle path. I just find it amazing.
I've been following along on your Instagram and have really been blown away by the first thing you mentioned, which is you're on dedicated bike lanes, but more so just the beauty of this part of France. I've actually never been to this, you know, this western coastal part of France. But are these just highlights that you see, you know, at one point during the day, or is it just stunning riding all the way along?
It's pretty scenic. I mean, any bike trip has some grunt work in it, right? It's not continuous beauty, but it's pretty nice. I mean, there's some days where we've been cycling all along the sea, but only saw it at the beginning of the day and the end of the day. But part of that was just our own laziness because we didn't get off our bikes and walk over a massive sand dune to the other side where you could see the ocean, or because we had a long day, you know, ahead of us and we just wanted to get the kilometers done. But it's pretty scenic. Like there's long stretches right along the sea, or long, long stretches in pine forests as well, which are similarly quite pretty.
And I know your approach to bike touring has traditionally been, you like kind of wake up and not make too many plans, you know, not book accommodations 2 or 3 days in advance. With the pandemic, has that influenced? Do you have to start planning more in advance, or can you still kind of wake up and say, oh, we're going to cycle 80 kilometers to this town, so we'll, you know, go on booking.com and find a nice inn or guest house in that town? Or do you have to plan farther in advance?
Well, we're really doing it day by day, and that's one of the reasons why we like to cycle in the spring and fall when things are less busy. I don't think that we could do that if it was July or August. But no, we're going day by day, and usually we look at, you know, what the weather's like and what the terrain's like, so we get an idea of how far we want to go or how our bodies are feeling. And yeah, then we also look at what's available. So on part of this route, there were days where, you know, options for accommodation were, you know, quite far apart, or there'd be accommodation at 30 kilometers and then not really anything appropriate until 80 kilometers. So then we'd have to decide, and usually we'd go 80 kilometers. But yeah, we mostly are doing it day by day. The only day that we pre-plan is Saturday, because Saturday nights fill up a lot.
So that's one where you book it several days in advance just to make sure you have a place to stay on the Saturday, or is that just something the night before you book it?
Definitely the night before, but what we figured out on this trip is that we try and get our Saturday to be either like a Friday, Saturday, or a Saturday, Sunday, you know, so, you know, we make it part of a rest day or something. We have had a few times where we thought we knew where we were going to stay, and then we waited too long to book it on a Saturday, and then we had to scramble for something else, because The other thing when you're doing a bike trip is you have to make sure where you're staying will take your bikes, because we brought our bikes with us from Canada, and we have nice bikes that are really comfortable. And so there's no way we're leaving them locked up on the street, no matter where we are. So usually when we're deciding where to stay, it involves calling or messaging whatever accommodation we're going to be at to make sure they have a secure location for our bikes.
And I know another nice thing traveling this time of year is, you know, hotel or accommodation rates can be a lot cheaper. You were mentioning just before we started the podcast, you know, what you were finding, but you know, maybe just share, you know, what should somebody budget for a nice hotel room on a nightly basis, you know, doing a trip like this in, you know, what is effectively the off season?
I think it really depends on what's a nice hotel for you, because there are a lot of very nice options here. We aren't looking for anything super luxurious. We're looking for a nice, very clean place, hopefully in a good location. We probably would pay a little bit extra, but I know we got one hotel in a really small town that was not on the sea, so probably not really much of a tourist town, but a really nice wee hotel, you know, probably a local, you know, hotel, mostly by businessmen. It was newly renovated. It was like 57 euros for the night, which just seemed incredibly cheap. Because you think like if you're staying in a hostel or something, two people, you'd probably pay that much, right?
Yeah, I know.
And then, I mean, on Saturdays and sometimes Fridays, everything's more expensive. So I bet you that place on a Saturday would be more expensive. In bigger places, you know, prices are going to be up. So maybe the most we've spent is you know, in general, maybe around 99 euros. But yeah, it really varies by location, how nice the place is, and the day of the week, I think. I'm almost positive that makes a difference.
So I know, looking at your photos, you know, my wife and I are planning, okay, we have to, you know, we have to explore this area. You know, the west coast of France just looks spectacular. But you're now into Spain, and you're dealing with, you know, northern Spain and just, you know, how it can be super wet. There's a reason why it's so lush and green. You're in San Sebastian. So what are your options for where you go from here?
Yeah, so we've been pushing pretty hard for us for the last couple of weeks, and we knew there was this big rain front coming. So we rented an apartment, and we're just having a couple rest days, and we're cooking some meals and drinking some wine and having coffee and fresh bread. And it's pretty sweet. But at the same time, we're planning where to go. If we were to continue on the Eurovelo 1, it goes down through the center of Spain, eventually reaching Seville. And then it goes out to the coast and along the south of Portugal and then back up towards Lisbon. So that's one option. And then the other option, and these two kind of overlap, would be to do the Camino of Santiago. And so that one goes inland along the north of Spain, ending up in Santiago de Compostela. And we're flying home from Lisbon, so whichever way we go, we have to end up at Lisbon. So that way, if we do that one, which is what we're leaning to, then we would cycle to Santiago. And then I think what we do is take the Portuguese Camino down the coast of Portugal to Lisbon. But the thing is, those two paths overlap for a few days from Pamplona to Burgos. They're both the same route there. So we actually don't have to decide for sure. There's a lot of rain coming, but most of it gets dropped on the coast here. So we decided we're going to take a train across the mountains to Pamplona, because in Pamplona, the weather, because we've been doing research on it, is a lot better. And then we'll start cycling there in a couple of days, you know, heading to Burgos and then deciding from there. So far, the next 2 weeks, the weather in Pamplona looks stellar.
So I know we're getting our first snows here in the Canadian Rockies. In your photos, it looks like it's wonderful weather, but heading into October, what are you expecting? You know, on both these routes, you're going to be, you know, kind of in central, you know, the center core of Spain. Are you going to be having to worry about, you know, it being too cold, or is it still going to be really pleasant weather throughout October for cycling?
Oh, really good weather. Yeah, like, because the weather forecast for most of that route on the Camino is highs around 20 during the day. And like I was saying, for the next 2 weeks, it's all sun. And then if we go down the center of Spain, which of interest is also the Camino de la Plata. And a couple of months ago, we talked to that woman who had walked that Camino. Well, that Camino is also Eurovelo 1. And that weather is similar. But in fact, that weather would get warmer the further south you got because, you know, right now in Seville, it's like 27, 28 degrees Celsius. It's very warm in Seville right now.
You know, I must say the idea of going, you know, cycling to Compostela and then going down the Portuguese coastal route with, you know, the great seafood and the charming little villages and then ending up in Lisbon, that seems very attractive. If I was there, I'd be really pushing to do that because, you know, just to spend time on the warm coast just seems fantastic.
Yep. Well, the only thing though is by the end of October, it may no longer be warm there. It might be warmer down in the Algarve. So.
Yeah. You're right. You probably have more potential for adverse weather if you do the Portuguese coastal route in late October.
Yeah, that's what we're thinking. Having said that, we may do it anyway.
Yeah, I know your love of cycling in adverse weather.
No, we're not too keen on that. I guess we're kind of wimpy compared to some of the cyclists that you talk to on your podcast.
I don't know how people do it, you know, going riding in rain all day, and especially people that are bikepacking. I just think they're so tough because, you know, to be soaking wet and then get into a damp sleeping bag in a sodden, you know, wet tent and then wake up the next morning and do it all over again. You know, it's just I've done stuff like that. It's so unpleasant. And I'm always impressed when we talk to people or I meet people that have done those trips because it's really, really tough to be motivated when you're cold and wet all like for 24 hours straight.
Yeah, actually that brings up, well, one subject is that we have had a couple of days of rain here and I got a brand new cycling raincoat and it was some new fabric that was, you know, very light, but very water resistant. And anyway, the bad news is that my raincoat is not that waterproof. My arms were soaking wet. My cycling rain pants are good, but my arms on the coat, for some reason, like my arms are soaking wet. So one day, also a rain day, we spent the day at Decathlon, which is, you know, a huge outdoor or sports retailer. And I got a new pretty much slicker type raincoat and I haven't worn it in the rain. I'm sure it'll be waterproof, but there will be no breathing through that one. I'll probably end up wet for other reasons when I have to wear it.
If you have good rain gear, then your sweat and everything, it's like a sauna inside or a steam room. And if you got, you know, bad gear that breathes, then all the rain gets in. So you can't win, I don't think.
Yeah, that's true. Although I think if it were to start being cold and wet, having the slicker will definitely be of benefit.
Definitely. Well, Karen, it's been great to catch up and hear about how things are going. I know we're hearing more and more people that want to travel to, you know, Western Europe. They hear about all the good news in terms of how cases are low, how, you know, you're around a lot of other vaccinated people. I know we were talking before, and I think Spain has, you know, 4 new cases a day for every 100,000 inhabitants. I know here where I am in Western Canada, we're having 40 cases a day for every 100,000 inhabitants. It's something similar like that in the US. In the UK, it's over 50 cases a day. So, you know, just being in Spain, you're cutting your risk of coming into contact with someone else with COVID by, you know, over 90% in some cases, which is just really incredible. You know, you're able to kind of travel and, you know, obviously you still wear a mask inside and there are some restrictions, but it just seems like you're able now to kind of travel in a somewhat normal situation without just this constant concern of, you know, there's a massive, you know, pandemic going on. And so it's been great to hear, you know, how you've been experiencing this firsthand.
I feel very fortunate to be here right now and to get to do this right now. And the cycling's been great and I expect it will continue to be.
I think it's going to be wonderful. Now, if you want to be inspired, I would suggest follow Karen. She's at Adventure After All on Instagram. You know, the hard part is you're going to want to take a week off work, fly into Paris or Madrid and get on your bike because it just is so beautiful this time of year on the bike route she's doing.
Yeah, it really is. And maybe I'll catch up with you in a few weeks, Richard, and I'll tell you which route we ended up taking.
That sounds great. Thanks for being on the podcast today, Karen. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.